So welcome, folks. You are at the Working the Disaster Beat, and I'm Mark Schlefstein, an alleged environment reporter with the Times-Picayune, NOLA.com in New Orleans. To my left, we have Ryan Handy, Texas oil, gas, and utilities reporter with the Houston Chronicle. Jess Burns, Southern Oregon environment reporter with EarthFix. The inimitable Bruce Ritchie, Florida energy and environment reporter, now with Politico. And I'm going to quickly start off with just a couple of quick things about the storm that we have that's going to hit the New Orleans area and the Mississippi-Alabama coast overnight tonight, and talk a little bit about those sorts of things. I have this visual up here on the screen just for fun. This is a wind pattern website for the entire globe, and if I can get this thing working, you can see that it is the entire globe, which is pretty neat. So that's fun to do, and that's at earthnullschool.net. The sort of things that we're much more interested in are these kinds of satellite images that are available from the National Hurricane Center website. Fairly simple to find, and there are a variety of different versions of them that will help you identify what's happening with the hurricane. And this is up to date, more or less. And everybody looks at the forecast process, and this is as of 7 o'clock this morning, where it's located, the forecast path. It's actually the 4 a.m. forecast path, and where it's going. And then the colors on this graphic indicate areas where there are watches and warnings, both hurricane, this one just shows hurricane watches and warnings. The National Hurricane Center now issues separate storm surge watches and warnings, and actually puts out potential storm surge flooding maps. These are a worst-case scenario. The color code is down here. And you can see that greater than 3 feet above ground level is the light yellow. Greater than 6 feet is the orange, and then over on the Mississippi-Alabama coast, you can see that there's some red, which is greater than 9 feet, which is what you really have to worry about. Again, this one's from 4 a.m. It's been updated about that time. I would urge y'all to get in touch with your local forecaster, the National Weather Service office, and demand that you be put on NWS chat. That's the chat room that's set up for TV meteorologists mostly, and for emergency managers, and it has much more up-to-date information, plus all links to everything that is going on that affects your National Weather Service office. And if they give you grief about, oh, we just don't do that, you say Mike Ussolini, the head of the National Weather Service, has said that all journalists who cover weather are allowed on this, and send them to Ussolini or to me. Okay, so that's basically it. Nate has got winds of 85 miles an hour at 7 o'clock this morning, which is not good. The forecast for 4 a.m. is for it to hit as a 90-mile-an-hour storm, which is the top of a Category 1. If it goes to Category 2, that's sort of a problem. Okay, so what do reporters need? Well, we're aggressive sons of guns, as I'm sure you know. We have to recognize that we live in a changing media scenario. Things are changing so quickly that these are pictures that were taken during Hurricane Katrina, which ended up being an event that's sort of set the future for a lot of organizations, including ours. Advanced .net basically decided to completely change all of their newspapers to more online as a direct result of this. And the reason for that was this: 72 million page views around the world in 4 days during Katrina, 30 million page views on Friday, after the storm. And that it's just amazing. So we're now all doing print and online around the clock, and we're doing everything all at once, and reporters are being required to do that, and we're getting continuously updated on how to use our iPhones and everything else. Spin is what you should expect out of emergencies, whether they're hurricanes or other things. This is the infamous Michael Brown and our former governor and our former senator talking about what he thought was going on without much knowledge. We also have a trust problem. You know, we took the head of the state's Coastal Protection and Restoration Authority, who's now a member of Congress, took this picture during the BP oil spill because he thought it just said so much. The BP spill was something that was run, the response to it was run by both the Coast Guard and BP, and having the BP truck filling the Coast Guard plane meant so much. Let me dump through a bunch of other things. The thing you have to worry about when you're covering things like this is bias and balance at all times. This is an example of that. This is the 17th Street Canal immediately after Hurricane Katrina. That flood wall failed because of failures of the Army Corps of Engineers that were documented by the Army Corps of Engineers eventually, but were also documented by independent researchers within a couple of days of the storm. They built the wall wrong, and it resulted in huge amount of flooding, including to my house. And so I had to put that in a box and say, yeah, I don't hate the Corps of Engineers, and it turned out that I really don't, and the reason for that is because I recognize that the decisions that were made generations ago, literally, largely by one engineer in the New Orleans District Office who was already dead by the time Katrina came along. So I had that knowledge and was able to deal with that, plus the fact that just as 40% of our employees lost their homes during Katrina, about 40% of Corps of Engineers employees lost their homes as well. The thing that I have to stress is that when you're in the midst of a disaster, it's not the time to be figuring out how to cover it and who you should be talking to. This is us evacuating from our building on Tuesday morning, 2 days after Katrina hit. And we had to do that because of the floodwaters that were rising around our building. We also have to make sure that we get correct information, and knowing who's giving that information and knowing what their backgrounds are in advance helps you decide whether or not to believe what they're telling you. This was a spill pipeline in Arkansas, where they said, "Oh, there's no problem, you know, no health issues." There will be a lot of controlling the health issues. I mean, controlling the messages. After Katrina, you had the Coast Guard chief of the Coast Guard going out on boats and saying, "See, we've got fish, and they don't look really that bad." Find other ways of getting around it. The Coast Guard basically put a ban on reporters going out to barrier islands to look at pelicans. And so we just said, well, let's just go to the president of the parish where the island is, and he will bring us out there himself with the governor. That works. Make sure in your stories that you explain what you don't know and that it's clear. And again, this is a map of yesterday's storm surge, what's going on in that. So I'm going to stop there, and let's sort of move down the panel and talk about some of the issues about covering these sorts of things. We're going to start with Ryan, who's going to talk to us a little bit about the Chronicle's efforts and what they've been going through. And let me give you the speech.
Okay. If anyone can't hear me, just let me know. So I'm Ryan Handy with the Houston Chronicle. I'm normally a part of our five-person energy team. I cover oil and gas regulation, the regulation of power, the power industry, and renewables. And my background is actually in wildfire reporting in Colorado. I just moved to the Gulf Coast about a year ago. I don't know anything about hurricanes. I don't know anything about flooding. And I was actually just taken off my beat right after Harvey and put on a team of people who are covering Harvey full time. And my assignment is the National Flood Insurance Program and flood mapping issues. A lot of what Mark has mentioned and I saw in his slides really resonated with my experience at the Chronicle. The Chronicle has undergone a lot of turnover and transformation, and most of our veteran Chronicle employees are now gone. The staff is really new. Some of us are, you know, still early on in our career, and our management is entirely new to the Gulf Coast, and as far as I'm aware, had never directed the coverage of a hurricane before. I have never covered a hurricane. There were a handful of employees in the room who have covered them. Some of our actually more experienced environmental reporters had just left the newsroom, either retiring or getting new jobs elsewhere. So we have a staff of about 200 to 250. So it is a big paper. But the thing I found really interesting about covering Harvey, unlike the wildfires I covered, I mean, the wildfire starts and before you know it, it's a huge deal, and you just had no warning. But with a hurricane, you have a forecast, you have plenty of warning that it's going to come. And I don't think anyone in Houston really envisioned how bad it was going to be, namely if like 4 feet of water. But we knew that it was going to be really bad. And so we had plenty of time to prepare and plenty of time to make sure we had all of the reporting we needed kind of in place. Which I personally did not do. So I spent the hurricane actually trapped in my house, which was totally fine. I live in a neighborhood called The Heights, which is aptly named. It's the highest point in Houston. I think it's maybe like 56, 59 feet above the rest of the city, and that makes a difference. I couldn't get out of my neighborhood for a week, and I had power, and I had internet, and so I just worked from my house. But several employees were flooded. The woman across from me had a foot of water in her house in Meyerland, which is a notoriously flood-prone and low-lying neighborhood in southwest Houston. One of our copy editors lives in Conroe, North Houston, and his entire house was underwater. The thing that I did not anticipate, with a wildfire, pretty much everyone can get to work. With a hurricane, no one could get to work. And so you have a newsroom of hundreds of people that are stranded all over the city. Everyone's desperate to be of use and to be helpful, and with a limited amount that we could do. Excuse me. That was really challenging because already during a disaster, it's really difficult to organize a staff. And if most of your staff isn't there, and if most of your staff isn't in contact, it was really hard to know who was doing what and when. So I found, both as a wildfire reporter and covering Harvey, one of the best things you can do is develop a really specific staffing plan. And the staffing plan should include who is working, when they're working, how to reach them, and where they're going to be working. And you need to have one of these every single day. The day should begin and end with a staffing plan. So as a reporter trapped in a remote corner of Houston, I know who to call to edit my copy. I know which web producer to call to fix a typo or get an evacuation map up. I can look at the staffing plan and see who was at the OEM and who was in Meyerland or who was in Conroe. And I know where the photographers are. It's absolutely invaluable, particularly when most of your staff is out and isn't, you know, just a desk away. The other big lesson that I took from Harvey is there's a lot of reporting that you can do before the hurricane, before the storm, that would have been really, really useful, particularly about the National Flood Insurance Program. I have spent, it's been over a month since Harvey, I spent the entire month reading about the National Flood Insurance Program and carrying around all of these reports with me everywhere. There's an incredible amount of literature from the government about the National Flood Insurance Program. Government accountability reports, the Congressional Budget Office have written about this program ad nauseum, and everyone knows the problems with it. It's notoriously broken. They're very well documented. The other thing that we should have done before the hurricane that we did not do was identify how many homes were in the 100-year floodplain and how many homes are in the 500-year floodplain and how many homes are part of the National Flood Insurance Program. All of this information FEMA has. We just requested it a couple weeks ago, and they will give you the number of homes, the zip code, the year they were built. We're trying to get specific addresses. They're fighting that. We'll see how that goes. There's also homes that they call severe repetitive losses, which are homes that just sounds just like what it is, that have had flood damage multiple times. They have agreed to give us a list of those as well. And those are really invaluable because they give you a sense of where the flooding is likely to occur, the neighborhoods that have had recurrent issues. It gives you a sense of how many people, you know, went through the storm with some level, with some sort of safety net, and it gives you a sense of how many people have no safety net at all. And that's one of the narratives that's emerging from Harvey, is the sheer number of people who didn't have flood insurance. And part of that is because the storm, I mean, it's the worst storm that we've ever had in Houston, and it eclipsed all of our other major flooding from Hurricane Allison in 2001, from Ike in 2008, from the Tax Day flood in 2016, and the Memorial Day flood in 2015. It's just totally unprecedented. So all of that kind of data and information is readily available, and all you have to do is contact FEMA now and get it and have it. And I have wasted so much time in the past month getting a bunch of reporting that could have easily been gotten before the hurricane happened. Our assignment now at the Chronicle is we have a team of us who've been assigned to dog certain issues. So I'm on flood insurance. We have someone who's on FEMA. We have some people who are on affordable housing, fraud and charities. So assigning people to those beats, I found, has been really crucial. It does mean, unfortunately, that some of your other beats are going to be dropped. My beat, no one is covering it for the foreseeable future. And that's a big deal in Houston, where, you know, the power industry is very prominent. So just as much as it is important to have a plan during the hurricane or during the disaster of who's covering what, I think it's really important to have a plan of who's covering what afterwards. In a newsroom of 200 and plus people, I cannot tell you how many times I've started a story that someone else was already working on. It's unbelievable. So I think we're still working on that. I think we're still trying to figure out who is covering what. And I'm hoping that as the months go by, that we'll have a cleaner and clearer plan of who will be following up on what.
Jess, let me skip you, if I could. Bruce, let me get you to talk a little bit about it. We'll continue with hurricanes for a couple of minutes.
Okay, great. I didn't really have a chance to talk to Mark about this, but, you know, there's a bus down there right now, and we're talking about hurricanes. We could all get up and head down to Biloxi and be right there and discuss this and be back by lunch, I think, don't you? All right, let's go. Okay, no one's following. It's like Steve Martin, just lead everyone out the door, but no one follows. It's great to be here. There are reporters in Florida who've covered worse hurricanes or more hurricanes or been in the midst of terrible hurricanes, but they're not in Pittsburgh today, and I am. The message was to talk to you all about how to stay safe during a storm. And it's really easy. Stay indoors. You're not covering the weather. You're covering the preparations leading up to, and you're covering the recovery afterwards. You're not a weatherman. You're not Jim Gentori. So that's easy. And I've got a tip sheet online now with the agenda, and it's ideas for hurricane coverage or let's go camping, because that's kind of what it is. I'm wearing my coverage outfit right now. Nylon zip-off pants, quick dry shirt. I'm not wearing my Gore-Tex boots, but you know, pretty much if I have to go somewhere to cover a hurricane, I just load up tents, sleeping bags, cots, lots of water, dry food, lanterns, ropes, personal flotation device, life jackets, even a canoe or kayak. Because, you know, we saw on TV the reporter who was sitting there in Houston watching the water level rise on a truck driver. If she had a rope or a flotation device, she could have thrown him. There wouldn't have been quite as much drama. it's important, I think, to get to know your emergency management director, your state emergency operations center before a storm, before hurricane season. You know, put together a sheet of phone numbers and names, and talk to them and tell them you expect to be there on briefings. What are the briefing schedules? You expect to be able to stay there overnight, perhaps a few days. You'll be equipped to sleep in a corner if you're given that opportunity. We had a recent dust up down in Florida where this year suddenly the audio to the briefing room, the news media room at the Emergency Operations Center was just cut off. And the explanation, when I started asking it back in July and we finally got it in September during Irma, was that it was exempted information from the state public records law, that we couldn't hear that. And they actually cited me law this week that said it's information about security, readiness, evacuation, anything offered by a business. I mean, it was just broad exemption. It was unbelievable. And yesterday, lo and behold, the governor's office informed the Capitol Press Corps that it was being lifted. And I wrote a story yesterday about it while I was listening to some panel and posted it. And it's certainly good to work that out ahead of time next time. And but the Emergency Operations Center is where you hear the stuff. I mean, that's where you hear we have a bridge out, we have a road down. I mean, someone's stuck in a tree waiting for a rescue. So focus there, be there, and if you're going to be somewhere during a storm, be there, because the roof probably won't blow off. And I think that about covers it. I put some links on my tip sheet, and this tip sheet was the first iteration. I really hadn't put that much thought into it, but one is the NOAA River Prediction Centers is a good site to focus on. So because you can have a storm hit over here, and 100 miles to the east, 2 days later is where you have the flooding. And one thing editors seem to often do is we'll assign people geographically to cover storms. And then after the storm, they sort of all change everything up and they forget about an area over here or an area over there that needs the coverage still. I always feel like, listening to Ryan, it sounded great the way they have divided the beat up post-Harvey. It's almost good to think about that pre-Harvey and think about sectors of the economy or sectors of society that are going to get hit. Your utilities, your fishing industry, your tourism, your marinas, your crops, your farmers. One of the largest, we had $2.5 billion in damage, just agriculture from Irma, and one of the largest sectors was the floriculture industry. I never heard of floriculture until this week. It's flower growing. And there's a lot of good stories there if you tend to not just sort of geographically and think of destruction, but if you think of economic harm. So that's my rambling thoughts. Thank you.
Okay, so next we're going to have Jess, and she's going to talk about the kind of disaster that hits you when you're not expecting it.
Yeah. I'm Jess Burns. I work for Oregon Public Broadcasting as part of environmental reporting team in the Pacific Northwest called Earth Fix. We serve all the public radio and television stations, CPB-funded stations in the Northwest. I am based in Southern Oregon. My geographic beat area is about the size of Pennsylvania, with about less than 1% of the population. So it's very rural. Everything is very far apart. It is there's a huge amount of public land. Most of the land down there is owned federally. We got a matrix of kind of Forest Service, National Park Service, BLM. Timber's the big business. A little bit of mining, but as far as like extractive industries. And so when fire hits, screaming begins about the timber industry and how we should manage forests. The fire that I covered this year was called the Chetgo Bar Fire, and it started burning in the Calmeopsis Wilderness in southwest Oregon, very rugged coastal mountain range. Or part of a coastal mountain range that was between where I'm based, which is in the Rogue Valley near the California border, and the coast. Lightning started fire, which it mostly is in these remote areas. And it's a fire that burned for 3 weeks at about 5,000 to 10,000 acres. And it's up in the wilderness area, and ecologically, they really should let it burn. They didn't take that full approach, but there were some issues with terrain and weather that were happening that were not letting them really put in crews to try to contain it. Things got crazy when this weather phenomenon, it's called the Chetgo effect, and this hot water, hot air kind of tidal wave pulls down the Chetgo River Valley, and it basically is like a blast furnace, high winds, hot, dry air coming from the inland down to the coast, and that kicked up at about 3 weeks in, and the fire within 2 days, 2 to 3 days, went from about 10,000 acres to 90,000 acres. It spread extremely fast. I was on vacation when that happened, and a colleague was brought in that worked the fire for a little while, and then I was kind of the second wave. And the concern was the fire had burned down within about 5 miles of the town, a coastal town called Brookings. Not a huge population area, but a big tourist economy there, a lot of floriculture. Yeah, it's the lily capital of the United States. If you buy lilies, you probably came from this area. Cranberry farming as well, and a lot of private timber, a lot of private timber harvest, private timberlands there. It strikes me that I think that there's something to think about with wildfire. A lot of the wildfires that get a lot of attention are the ones that really kind of bump up to urban areas. The Eagle Creek fire burning in the Columbia Gorge. Us in Southern Oregon and in the Jefferson Public Radio newsroom that I am, we rolled our eyes as everyone at OPB was deployed to cover this fire. And the Chetgo Bar, which was the number one firefighting priority nationally for several weeks, and was one ridge away from burning a town down, was like, it was me. You know, like, I think that the reporting aesthetics and the reporting strategies you would use in an urban area and a fire threatening an urban area is probably very different. But for these rural fires, when I was thinking about coming and doing, giving this talk and thinking about who else was on the panel and kind of what you would have to deal with in a hurricane. I grew up on this in the Southeast Coast, so have lived through many of them. I think the difference is not, for me at least, it was not. It's remoteness. It's not kind of the scarcity that you find is not because of kind of disaster. It's more because of remoteness. And then you have these tiny towns that are probably growing in population because of all the firefighters coming in by maybe double. And then you just have a huge strain on the resources there. So that's just kind of one thing to, I would say, consider. Otherwise, my beat is environment. It's pretty broad for Southern Oregon, so it covers a lot of different avenues. But I came in there wanting to not do, I didn't want to do the, I wanted to find the environmental stories that were there. And when you're in these situations, you're reporting on the day-to-day churn of the disaster, basically. And I was really trying to get away from that. And that's very difficult. And it's also very difficult to convince your editor that you should do something a little bit different, because just as all the firefighting priorities are, you know, a journalist organization, you should be looking at life and property. And so we did that, but just as I was there, I was trying to think for the long term. This place is not close, so I was gathering string for other stories as I was going along. So I would try to think of it that way. The way that fires are structured, or fire command is structured, usually there's an incident command post that is going to be where you want to go. Now, they don't really accommodate you as a reporter at all. You go and you make the best of what situation. This fire was so remote and so rural that they did not do press briefings. Like, I had to seek out everything. There was maybe another couple press in town for this, and I never saw them. I just heard about them. So, I mean, it was really kind of, you kind of had to navigate yourself. There was no, it wasn't set out for you that, oh, if I just go to this and I can get all the information I need, blah, blah, blah. So kind of getting the lay of the land that way and kind of making friends at the incident command post. And also, just from an environmental journalism standpoint, I found that once it looked like the line was going to hold, it was touch and go, but once it looked like the weather was going to calm down, it was going to give firefighters enough time to kind of fortify these lines, these containment lines, and the spotting had kind of the fire when they send out embers and start other fires had kind of backed off. I found that there's a group of people that work fires, and they're called, shorthand for them is READ, they're resource advisors. And these are your scientists. These are the biologists. These are the ecologists, the archaeologists. And I found that they were an amazing source for understanding what was at stake ecologically, culturally, and that put me on to several of the environmental angles. And one, at least the way that it was structured for this fire, and I got the feeling that it was all of the Pacific Northwest, maybe beyond, is that the READs don't answer to the incident commander directly. They are serving the local Forest Service or the local BLM. Their masters are elsewhere. They are brought in at the pleasure of land managers locally. And so it seemed to afford them a certain amount of freedom. They were a little bit cautious, but once I was in with the top person, there was not a blink of an eye about hooking me up with everyone on the staff and that they were working with and letting me do that. So I feel like looking for environmental stories, that's a really key place to go. And that's the practical tip that I'll give. Okay, I'll end with that. They're resource advisors.
Okay, so I'm going to go ahead and just open it up for questions. Right before I do that, though, let me just add one thing to what Bruce was saying. A lot of times, you do have the situation where the state emergency operations center is far away from the site. So in Florida, my assumption is it's in Tallahassee, right? So that's way far away from Miami, to say the least. So if you're covering the actual location where the storm is coming in, I will do the same urging that I do to my own editors, and which they sometimes listen to and sometimes do not, and that is, go to the shelter, do not go to a hotel or a motel. And the reason for that is because I will give you an example. Hurricane Andrew, 1992, after it devastated Miami, crossed the Gulf of Mexico and hit southern Louisiana. And we sent a reporter and photographer to Morgan City. And over my objection, the editor sent them to a motel. The roof blew off the motel onto their car, and they were stuck there. And no one came to even look for them for a day, okay? If they had gone to the shelter, the roof blew off the shelter. Much larger, real story than a roof blowing off a motel, right? And they had people there to move them to places of safety. They had everything they needed, and they had access to communications. So remember who you are and where you and what you're trying to do. Your role is to get information out to the public, and that should be your first priority. Other places to embed, which is what we call it, is to get in touch with the National Guard in advance and say you want to go out with National Guardsmen who are doing response work, and often they will allow you to do that. You can actually do that from the shelter, because the National Guard is delivering people that they've rescued to the shelter, and you can just jump on the truck when they go back out, that sort of a thing. If you do have a major levee area that with a levee district, talk to the levee district, see if you can get embedded with them, and again with the Army Corps of Engineers, similar sort of a thing. Okay, questions.
Can I there's one thing I wanted to mention about kind of health and safety and wildfires, and I sent him photos and then did not talk about them. This is hazardous smoke level 5 miles away from the fire, and there are times when you probably want to try to get to the line, and you might want to try to pursue that story. That wasn't something I was so interested in, because the strategies are pretty much the same from fire to fire. But as far as a public health problem, this is serious. I mean, this for reporters' health as well. It was kind of early in the process, and I didn't fully understand how bad it was going to be. And I was not prepared as far as having like breathing gear needed. But this is this, and especially if you suffer from allergies or anything like this, this is going to make your life miserable. So just keeping that in mind, that that could happen. So, all right, sorry.
Okay. Gentleman in blue. Oh, and let me just say in advance that first questions come from a working journalist, and you've got blue badges, and then we'll open it up to everybody. Okay. Yes, sir. Okay, so the question is, how do you get past National Guard and police lines to deal with some of this these reporting things? Well, again, if you embed first, if you make those arrangements in advance, it helps. I will tell you that after Hurricane Katrina, the way we made our way through National Guard and other people who were blocking people from coming into the community was that we had copies of our newspaper. And we gave them a copy of the newspaper, and they let us through. It was that simple. Even if you have any other sort of information, or if you've got a, you know, bring a bag of candy bars, bribery works. I will just tell you that.
I think probably.
Sorry, who is it?
I think probably Bruce is maybe better equipped to talk about this than I am, but I do have some lessons learned about that. I think we had a couple reporters who tried to go in with, like, the Cajun Navy And, I mean, Texas is full of lots of people with boats and guns, and they just went out there by themselves and tried to rescue people, and some reporters kind of got on with them. There are a bunch of people with those, like, monster trucks that are lifted above the flood level, and so they found people with trucks, they found people with boats, they found people with their own rescue operation, which makes for a really good story, but a lot of those people aren't equipped to deal with the hazards, so downed power lines. There was actually a rescue boat that had a couple journalists. I'm sure everyone read this story. I think they were from the Daily Mail. And the boat bumped into something, and two people were knocked overboard, and one of them was electrocuted. So I think, for me, we learned that, you know, it's probably better to go with people who know what the risks are going to be. Other concerns were the floodwaters were like this toxic stew of, you know, stuff that could get you sick. So a lot of people didn't really have the equipment necessary to deal with that, or the boat wasn't sturdy enough. So just a thought on taking the alternative route. And the other thing I actually just wanted to say with wildfire, similar problem getting to access some places. And I did get certified to fight wildfire. I got my red card. And just as a note, I have found the success of that in getting to the fire line with having that card depends on the state. In Colorado, I was never able to get, they would never let me get in the fire line. And I've heard in California it's different. It might be different in Oregon, but there's a similar access issue with wildfire. You have to take a class, S-130, S-190. You can get certified. You have to pass a physical fitness test called the PAC test. It's I think it's, Michael, correct me if I'm wrong. It's like a mile under 45 minutes with a 60-pound pack.
I think it's 3 miles.
3 miles, right.
With a 35-pound pack, or 45-pound pack.
Yeah, I think, the one I did was like this, I think, the higher level. Anyway, so, and you have to get renewed every year. Any local fire station. I got it from the Colorado Springs Fire Department.
It's a federal certification.
Yeah.
Through the National Emergency Coordination Center, which is basically all hazards, but it's basically about wildfire. And if you have to, if I typed in on this just briefly,
You can't hear you. If you want to come on up,
sure.
and identify. No, you got to come up and use the mic.
Sure. Michael Kotis with the Center for Environmental Journalism at the University of Colorado Boulder and author of Megafire. On wildfires and it also with hurricanes, when on the few times I've covered hurricanes, but also particularly on wildfires, a lot of times you are better off just finding your own way in. And so to give a specific example of that, and Ryan will know of this too, there's a photographer at the Denver Post named Helen Richardson. Her husband's a firefighter. She's got her red card. She's an amazingly fit photographer who does a lot of the outdoor climbing, mountaineering journalism. Fires break out, she has a trail map out, and she's mapped her way in, and she does not go and talk to the incident commanders or the command center at all. She figures out her own way in and has gone in and made profound photos and done terrific coverage, but also really irritated incident commanders. One thing that the Denver Post was able to do was to find out every home that burned in the Waldo Canyon fire when incident commanders would not tell people whether their homes had burned or not, and publish a map showing you whether your house had burned. And the response to that was for police to show up with a subpoena at the Denver Post, hoping to arrest Helen and a couple other of their journalists, which was turned away. But in any case, you don't want to do that if you're not familiar with the terrain and you're not trained for that. But there are creative ways to. I mean, these are big, vast disasters. It's not like they can man every trail and every road and every access point.
And ostensibly, you do have access because oftentimes it's burning on public land.
Yeah. Yeah,
so.
Particularly in wildfires, you're dealing with public land, and I've had that argument before and won it, you know, where, you know, you can't keep us out. And the other thing is that you're right, it's state by state. California has laws that basically they can't keep you if you're properly equipped and have a red card away from the wildfire, and Colorado has nothing like that. So know the laws in your state that grant you access.
I'll add to that we have a reporter who now works for us, Tristan Burrick, who was in Kitsap, Washington, and he got his card and asked to go up on a fire, and they said, yeah, but you have to work it. Yeah. Okay. Next question. If you could identify yourself, please.
Antonia Yuhas. I read on oil energy, oil issues in particular, and I wrote the book Black Tide, The Devastating Impact of the Gulf Oil Spill. Well, pitch our books here. So I'm particularly interested in the oil and gas and energy impact. It sounds like we didn't have you on that meeting, but that's your beat, which is unfortunate. But in particular, I guess the difficulties of getting information on the impacts, because one of the things I was noticing in trying to track it from California was we're always dependent, obviously, on federal and state information, but I became even more keenly aware than during the Obama administration of that dependence with the Trump administration and with the governments in place in Texas and Florida about how we kept getting information that said that information is not available, we're waiting to get the information from the companies, we're not going out to get it ourselves, and you know the challenges of finding out what the ongoing impacts, particularly to oil, gas, and energy infrastructure, are or have been.
Okay, so the question is basically how do you figure out ongoing impacts to oil and gas infrastructure during a disaster, whether it's a hurricane or an oil spill or something else?
I'll answer a little part. Ryan, I'm sure, can answer better. But it was very interesting to me that at the Emergency Operations Center during Irma, they had the guys from GasBuddy.com. It's an app in which you, which I've been using for years to find the cheapest gas price around. I'm just a cheapskate, so like 2 cents cheaper over there, and it has a map showing you the prices. Well, GasBuddy during the disaster activates a gas tracker system, in which it tells you what stations are open and which aren't, which have power, which don't, which have fuel, but do not. And so they got those guys in the Emergency Operations Center and incorporated them into their briefings, which we were cut off from and not able to hear. But I did talk to them and got on their blogs and followed their data and wrote a story this week in which we talked about how during the big hurricanes of 2004 and 2005, I need to show you my cool shirt. Be sure and make a cool shirt after hurricane season so it helps you at parties. After 2004, 2005, they enacted laws in Florida to require gas stations to have hookups for generators. Some local governments were requiring gas stations to have generators. It turned out that they did not require them to have the generator. So this year there was some bit of contention as to gas stations were without power and they did not have their generators. The retail gasoline industry says it's too expensive, it's too much of an investment with not enough return. I wrote a story this week saying that it's going to be kind of more of a struggle to find out this year what you can do legislatively to address the gas shortages we had. And a lot of people, even the AAA and the Gas Buddy guys, were saying, you know, we had 6.5 million people evacuating from South Florida. It's kind of hard to have enough gas on hand for that. And all. And Florida has a great tradition when they say, only buy as much gas as you need to evacuate. Everyone says, buy, go fill up everything now. So, sorry.
So I don't cover the biggest oil and gas impacts in Texas were the refineries on the Gulf Coast, and I don't cover those. But I do have a few lessons learned that might be of help. So we had the same problem. I mean, we all have these companies that we talk to, and we tried to check in with the companies, and we sort of discovered they weren't really telling us what was going on. So we discovered, I'd never heard of it before, a Coast Guard-run website called the National Response Center. Mark's laughing. The website, they have an updated spreadsheet of all of the spills. We discovered that before the companies were telling us about the spills or before the Texas Railroad Commission, which is the oil and gas regulator, believe it or not, and before the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality would tell us about them, these spills would be reported on this pretty extensive spreadsheet. And it was actually kept up to date, like within a day. The thing that was tricky about it was, though, that like one of the biggest gasoline spills first appeared on that website much smaller than it actually was. So when you look at it, it's worth checking into everything and checking how they update it, because some of the spills are bigger than they actually are as reported, or they're smaller than they are as reported. So had I to do this over again, I would have, and we didn't really have this, I would have preferred to have a team of us that were assigned to dog that website and to track and see where the spills are and what they were going to be. The second thing that we've done following the hurricane is file open records requests with the Railroad Commission to look at all of the spill reports that were received during the hurricane. The hurricane hit sort of kind of south of Corpus Christi, or maybe a little bit east of it, and that's pretty far south from the biggest oil and gas country in Texas, but it was close to the Eagle Ford Shale, which is kind of in southwest, so kind of south central Texas. So we're just now starting to understand some of the impacts to the oil and gas operations in that area. The Railroad Commission, is notoriously very difficult to deal with. I have to say, though, the records people get you your stuff eventually. They just take a long time. We've actually gotten quite a few tips and reports about spills that have happened since the hurricane in the Eagle Ford. And then there's a few, there is actually quite a bit of, there are older oil and gas fields right around Port Lavaca, which is right near where the hurricane hit, and they're much older, like 80-year-old oil fields, and they're actually owned by Hillcorp. And there's a lot of little independent oil and gas stuff, around there that is showing up in the spill reports as well. I don't think they're anything huge, but we'll see what they are.
So there's also let me go back to the National Response Center thing. There are reports on which that spreadsheet is based that back them up. There are local groups that are mining the spreadsheet and putting the reports up online in the New Orleans area. It's it's not Lean. It's but Sky Truth was my next comment. Sky Truth helps in doing it. It's the Bucket Brigade, Louisiana Bucket Brigade, and the other thing is to get in touch with Sky Truth and some of these other organizations that are flying that are actually going out there and taking pictures, because they actually have much better idea of what's going on than some other people if they can get in there. Then in terms of finding out what's going on at refineries, remember that if you go to their local websites, there may be something that they're putting up to tell their employees what's going on, or a phone number for employees to call in to find out the status of the plants. That might be useful until you get caught using it. In addition, counties, parishes often have dialed down systems of warnings for spills and other things that you may be able to sign up for to get information that way. The other is the NWS chat. Often they're going to be getting reports from local emergency managers of things that are going wrong, and they're putting little notes up on the NWS chat in real time, so you're then able to call them and say, well, it's National Weather Service is reporting this, you need to tell me what's going on. So a couple of things. Okay, young lady in the middle. Find a landline. That's sadly I mean, you know, during Katrina, we had a huge problem. There were no, all the towers went down, there was no way of getting any communications. And so we ended up having reporters who were in houses in Uptown, the sliver, what they now call the sliver by the river because it was not flooded, and they had a landline and electricity. For some odd reason, we still can't understand. But so the reporters would find their way to that house and then call us where we were outside of the area putting together things. That's one way of doing it. Beyond that, sat phones are possible, but you know, then you got to get the newspaper or whatever your news organization is to put the money into buying a sat phone and having an account. And that's.
Didn't you say texting,
Mark? We didn't realize it until after. You know, some people realized it during, but often other people didn't realize until after the first couple of days that you could actually use the text for text messaging on your cell phone. And it would work when the other communications were not working. I guess so. I don't know it's just the text thing.
Different service providers work better in different areas. It's good to know that ahead of time. So some places Sprint would work really well,
I think it also makes a difference if it's a wind event or just a flooding event, because in Houston it was just a flooding event, so we didn't lose our cell phone towers, but we did have the power problem. So what a lot of us did was we would get enough gas in your car, charge your car, and we would use our car as the place where we would recharge all our equipment and all our phones and stuff like that. And my mom actually sent me a radio, so when I didn't have charging my phone or I didn't have service, I had a radio. But I mean, like, you can't, you know, dispatch a story over the radio. So I was really worried if we had lost power and we had lost cell service. I had no idea how we were going to communicate with anybody.
Well, but keep an old-fashioned landline in your house, one that's not cordless, the old push-button phones. They work even when power's out.
Okay, Bruce.
Yeah. I'm wondering about if any of you have had experience covering the types of contracts your local governments enter into during the emergency declarations, and if you've ever found any stories there.
When you say, you're asking about contracts for... that are resulting from an emergency declaration, like for
professional work, you can just, you know, sign all kinds of agreements without going through any process.
Okay, so that can be a problem. There are usually I know that in Louisiana, the state already has agreements in place for a variety of different response companies to come in as soon as there's an emergency declaration. But they also start issuing permits, emergency permits for everything. And as we saw at VPA this year, in every single area, they issued permits allowing people to get out of different requirements for energy, mostly. Covering it is difficult. As we learned after Katrina, there was a lot of corruption going on in the collection of debris, where you'd have a major company that was charging a fortune for debris, and then it was hiring contractors that were hiring workers for, you know, $7 an hour or less. To actually do the work. So that took a while to get out, it's just basic reporting that you're going to have to do to figure out what's going on.
Thank you.
I just want to add, I haven't found this yet with Harvey, I'm sure it's happening, but when I covered wildfires, it was the same problem. I was in Colorado Springs, and the city hired GE to do the debris cleanup. And we had discovered the same thing, that the mayor basically picked a buddy of his, and they gave him a permit, but they have this fast-track process that allows them to give them a permit without sending out, like, an RFP and having a bunch of other bids in there. So it is really interesting to see how much money they're getting, who are their subcontractors, how much are these people getting paid. We weren't able to get all of that information. The interesting thing about Houston is that the city itself is doing the debris cleanup. So people are going in and cutting out their sheetrock and their insulation, and they're throwing out their furniture. And the city has its own trash and recycling service. So the city itself is picking that up. And I have been curious to figure out, are they subcontracting that? How is that working? I'm not really sure.
As long as we're talking about debris, let me... that can be a significant problem after a hurricane especially and a flood event. I will tell you a funny, sad story after Katrina, which was that a couple of days after Katrina, I got a call from EPA who said, we want you to talk to the administrator of EPA about what's going on here. And so I said, sure, why not? I'm by this time in Baton Rouge, you know, in a t-shirt is the only thing I have left in my cell phone. And so we're talking, and he's telling me all these wonderful things that EPA is doing. And he says, and we've arranged to have all of the debris from New Orleans shipped out to landfills in other states. And it'll be picked up and taken by train. And I said, no, you won't. And he said, what do you mean? And I said, we have this thing called Formosan termites in New Orleans. And if you do that, you'll be spreading Formosan termites all over the United States. And he said, oh, okay, I guess we won't do that then. And so they halted doing that. The problem was that then they started making arrangements to open new landfills. Well, there's very little space to open landfills in South Louisiana. And it immediately caused major problems with communities that did not want huge landfills opened up in their backyards. And they went to court to stop some of the landfills, and that occurred. And the debris was eventually taken care of. But it's something to think about, is that there are always, you know, it's residual risk. You know, it's the things you don't think about until they bite you. And those are the things that you really have to figure out when you're trying to cover these things. My other example is during the BP oil spill. What was our worst problem in getting information during the BP oil spill? It was the fact that both the company and the federal agencies were holding 5 press conferences a day. And you had to go to every single one to figure out what was happening that second. And that limited the number of people who were actually getting out to figure out what the hell is really going on. So that's something to really worry about. Plus, they're all going around you. You know, both BP and the federal agencies had their Twitter and Facebook accounts manned and operating before they had public affairs officers on site.
One quick little thing. The Florida Attorney General is subpoenaing debris removal companies this week because of concerns about price gouging. I think the debris removal company said, yeah, we agreed, we signed contracts, but not for this much. I mean, not this much stuff.
Okay.
Smoke in Portland, that, you know, where the little fire was, but the smoke, the wind changed direction, so it was pretty bad.
Give your name again for the mic.
Christy George, freelance reporter. So I want to say two comments and then a question. Quick comment on fires. I covered one fire one time in Oregon, and they gave us complete outfits, you know, firefighter uniforms with emergency shelters. So I don't know if they do that everywhere, but they did do that in you know, Central Oregon.
Yeah, I have my, I have one in my, as part of my, my kit, basically.
Yeah.
I have a firefighting suit and shelter.
Yeah, I don't know if those shelters work. Do they work, Michael? Save lives? You know,
all of the 19 Granite Mountain hotshots deployed their shelters.
And they all died. Yeah, that's
so
what
have,
I thought.
They have saved lives. I'll say that Canada and Australia, it's a
they have saved lives.
The point was made that the Granite Mountain hotshot firefighters all use their emergency kits and still die.
Yeah, that's what I thought, but still. And then I want to tell you a New Orleans thing that I learned recently reporting, and that is that this is similar to the export of the Formosan termites. The rebuilding effort, apparently, I was told, involved bringing all this lumber from all over the place, and with the lumber came a new species of rat to to New Orleans and the whole area. So here's my question. This is a water panel, and I'm curious to know the role of water, I guess we know in Harvey, but the role of water in these various disasters, and you know, it's obviously different in fire and flood.
Well, I have a sort of tangential water thought that I learned that I think is really interesting. I actually have a story coming out about this tomorrow. The floodplain maps in the United States are based upon LIDAR, which is like a topography thing, and something called rainfall frequency data, which is basically the probability that a certain kind of storm will happen in a certain place over a certain square mile area. In Texas, our rainfall frequency data is 50 years old. So it was captured in 1961 based upon the first like 60 years of the 20th century. Harris County, where Houston is, has updated its data to 2001. I've discovered this whole world of hydrologists and water resources experts that are trying to update this data. And so even when you update a flood map, your understanding of the precipitation could be really outdated. I've also discovered that there's a similar sort of calculation they use for building dams called the probable maximum precipitation. It's supposed to be like this is the ultimate amount that this dam can withstand in terms of water, and the actual storm is never supposed to even come close to that. And in Texas, it matched it, and in some cases exceeded it by a foot. So that was a really big deal. So now we have to recalculate, you know, the amount of water that our dams are meant to hold back. And the other interesting thing I've learned about all these water calculations, whether they're the probable maximum precipitation or rainfall frequency, is they don't really calculate the changes of climate. And so there's really no way to factor in how climate change is going to impact amount of rainfall in Texas. And I know that the state climatologist is currently working on how to put that into the calculation, and he has no idea how he's going to do that, but I'll be interested to see.
So,
do it politically or scientifically.
Okay. So the we have a similar problem in New Orleans where we have a drainage system that was the best in the world when it was built in 1912 and still has the world's best pumping stations. But they were also built in 1912, so they have lots of problems. That's one thing to look at. When we had a major flood event in the city of New Orleans on August 5th of this year, where we had between 9 and 12 inches of rain that fell in 3 hours. And so the pumps were, the system was overwhelmed. It would have been overwhelmed as well, but it turned out that a third of the pumps weren't working. Okay, so that's one thing to look at, is make sure that everything that's supposed to be used to get the water out is working properly. So that's one thing to think about. The other thing is that there was a mantra that the Sewerage and Water Board in New Orleans used all the time, which is that the pumps are designed to remove the first inch of water during the first hour and a half inch every hour thereafter. Well, in the aftermath of the August 5th flood, I went back and checked to see what that was based on, and it was it never was clear what it was based on, but there were more modern, quote-unquote, estimates of what the reality was, and it was the Army Corps of Engineers that had done a study in 1996 in anticipation of building some improvements to the drainage system in New Orleans. And what they based it on was, again, the old National Weather Service rainfall data, which was out of date in 1996 and is still out of date, that indicated that a 100-year event, rainfall event for 24 hours, was 13 inches, and that it could be handled with first inch an hour and a half inch thereafter. However, a rainfall event for 1 hour was 3.5 inches, and there was no way you could get rid of that water. And that's the problem, is that we have been seeing increases in intense rainfall events really from the beginning of the 20th century, as I found out in reading the biography, the autobiography of Isaac Klein, of Isaac's storm, the 1900 Galveston storm. Well, he, when, you know, the Galveston Weather Bureau office was devastated, he was transferred to New Orleans, and that was the Southern Regional Weather Bureau office. And he did a basic review of what was happening and found out that the drainage system itself in New Orleans had increased the amount of rainfall in the area, and also had increased the heat, and the two were related. You build a heat island, and all of a sudden, in a wet atmospheric condition along the coast, you end up with the perfect conditions for creating rainstorms, because the heat rises and it creates larger clouds, and the clouds hold more water, and there's more water that falls. So all these little things add up, and you have to know what's going on.
In my 18 years in Tallahassee, it hasn't taken a direct hit from a major hurricane, but one of the most destructive storms was Tropical Storm Dennis, which brought with it a rogue wave that formed off of Tampa and, surprisingly to most everyone, wiped out seafood houses and floated away docks and homes along the coast, and took out U.S. 98, the scenic highway. So it's not the wind, it's the water.
And I guess with wildfire, the way that I think about water, it just kind of triggers these ideas that there is not broad understanding about how wildfire is fought. People don't understand that you're not putting out, that people aren't, they're not trying to put out wildfire. Like, I feel like there is not much understanding of that in the public. And consequently, you'll often hear calls, so this was burning near the coast, why don't you just dip seawater and bring it back? You got an unlimited supply of water, and fly it up into the mountains and drop it on. I mean, it's just a bad idea all around. But, you know, I think that part of reporting a wildfire is maybe trying to increase the understanding of the role that water plays, and how it is used, and so that's just what struck me, the kind of sigh by okay, you know, of the commanders trying to explain to an angry mob, or not mob, I guess, but that's hyperbole, but an angry crowd, that how could you allow the fire to burn this close to our city when you have the ocean there, you know, just trying to explain that and trying to increase that understanding. So
we're now at 10:22, and this was supposed to end at 10:15. We were told that we could run over for about 5 minutes, but now we're even beyond that. So I'm going to have to call it and tell folks to go out to the ballroom where coffee is available.